Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So Vic, do you think you might have ADHD?
Well, listeners keep emailing me telling me that they think I do, so probably.
Mind you, listeners also email us saying we talk too much about your mum's feet. So what do they know?
Yeah, fair enough.
I honestly had no idea about the connection between overdrinking and ADHD until we started this podcast.
About 40% of people that have had any sort of drinking issues also apparently have ADHD.
Whenever we chat to ex-drinkers, this comes up more than you'd believe. If you have ADHD or suspect you might, or just want to learn about this link, then we would encourage you to check out the I Have ADHD podcast.
It's the place where adults with ADHD find research-based information, validation, and tons of support.
This is the best way to feel less alone and hear some of the answers to the questions you've been sitting with for too long. You'll hear detailed descriptions of what it means to have ADHD and enjoy interviews with the foremost experts in the industry so that you don't have to read those ADHD books that are collecting dust on your shelf.
Yeah. Listen to the I Have ADHD podcast and learn how ADHD affects every aspect of your life. From the boardroom to the bedroom.
In the podcast, you'll also hear about their ADHD coaching program, which is called Focused. Focused is made up of three pillars: courses, coaching, and community. It is designed to help you build your own self-improvement program and is perfect for the ADHD brain.
And you can get $50 off the course just by using the code SOBER, S-O-B-E-R. So if you're tired of feeling stuck and don't know where to start, listen to the I Have ADHD podcast.
The kettle's boiled, Vic.
Great. Perfect timing. Just a dash of milk for me, please, mate.
Here you go. Shall we get started, then?
Have you ever woken up on a Sunday morning and said, I'm never drinking again, and then found yourself waving 50 bucks at a barman by happy hour?
Are you wondering why everyone else can stop at one, while you head to a dodgy after-party with a weird bloke called Disco Dave? If so, it might be time to take a deeper look at your relationship with your reliable social crutch, alcohol.
On each episode, we'll investigate our own dysfunctional dealings with booze and find out if it's possible to stop this deeply ingrained habit before things get too messy.
Yep, we're going to open up a shame shed of humiliating drinking stories to help you understand why waking up from a booze coma each weekend with a kebab sticking out of your top pocket might actually be negatively impacting your health.
Hamish and I are here to delve into what it's like being sober. An unwanted warts and all look into why giving up those cheeky pints or putting down those mummy wines will make you feel happier, help your anxiety and mental health, and turn you into the most sparkly, authentic version of you.
Won't that mean I become boring though, Vic?
Well, Hamish, we'll just have to wait and see. I'm Victoria Vanstone.
I'm Hamish Adams-Cairns.
And this is Sober Awkward. Now, Hamish, I did see our sound guy, Alan, at the weekend.
Did you?
Yeah, I haven't seen him for a while.
Yeah, nor have I.
He's his usual miserable self.
Yeah, that is his neutral gear. He's generally a little bit pissed off.
Yeah.
Kind of like he's got ants in his pants, you know? Something's pissed him off. And yes, it's not clear what it is, but it's a constant state.
He does have four children.
That'll be it. Yeah. That'll do it. More than one will do it, I reckon.
Yeah. He was out of his hole. He's usually in his little hole doing his sound recording and things. But he was out of the hole and it was lovely to see him.
What did you do with him?
Well, I just gave him a little stroke and put him back in the hole.
Put him back in his hole.
Yeah. Poor little Alan. Yeah. I think I'd like to be a bit more like Alan.
Interesting.
I would.
In what way?
Well, Alan does not seem to care about appeasing people, Hamish.
That's true, yeah.
That is so true, isn't it? He doesn't care whether he's invited to things. Mm. He wouldn't actually care if he was sent to live on the moon and never saw anyone ever again.
That is 100% an Alan trait. He doesn't give a shit what people think.
No. He is grumpy sometimes, but he just stays at home, eats Pop-Tarts, doesn't bother pretending to want to be invited to a barbecue. He'd rather just stay at home and eat a Mackey D's. He's not in his head, not worrying about the what's, when's, friends and whys of friendship groups is actually quite inspiring.
I never thought I'd hear you say the words, I wish I was more like Alan.
I find Alan is basically my hero now.
You have been slagging him off on this podcast for 2.5 years, and well, now you're coming round to it.
But I have a history of that.
Okay, go on.
I slag off things I don't understand. I always hated sober people.
Yes, but actually you wanted to be one.
But I wanted to be one, didn't I?
Okay.
So yeah, it's the same with Alan. I've always hated him, but now I want to be him.
So should I feel worried in the fact that you like me now, so you'll probably hate me? Are you going to go the other way on me?
No, I've always hated
you. Okay, so I'll come good.
You've come good, you're
right. 2-3 years from now, you'll like me.
You didn't know that I hated you before. It's only recently in the last 2 weeks I've started to like you again.
Okay, yeah, I'm an upward curve. Alan wouldn't care if he never spoke to anyone ever again. Our advice in this podcast today is be more Alan. It's good for your mental health.
Absolutely. But we are going to discuss something a bit Alan related. Well, not so much Alan related, more why I want to be more like him. Let's make it about me, Hamish, okay. I think, today. Today, we're going to discuss... the word makes a little bit of vomit come up in the back of my throat. Rejection.
I like you're saying, let's make today's episode about me, and it's all about rejection.
Yeah.
It's just the one word that sums you up.
It is just the word that I struggle the most with, okay. Honestly.
I understand.
It's something we all feel at some point in our lives. If not at school or by a family member, it can be in a relationship or when you get sober. Whenever it might happen to you, there's a guarantee. It's painful.
Every time.
Yep.
Rejection hurts. Feeling accepted by our friends and peers are one of those primal needs. So when we get pushed out, excluded, and made to feel like we no longer belong, it triggers strong emotions in all of us. Fear, sadness, loss, confusion, and it can really affect our mental health.
Now, I had a little look into this, and I found out there are quite a few forms of rejection, Hamish. For sober people, one of the main types is, of course, social rejection. But there is also friendship rejection, relationship rejection, familial rejection, which could be your parents, and job rejection.
You sound like that guy in Forrest Gump, listing all the prawns. Fried shrimp, barbecue shrimp, cold shrimp.
Oh, that's true. There are many different levels in which people feel rejection and shrimps. Some might get over it quickly and have a more, well, it's your loss attitude. And others may have something called rejection sensitivity. Now, this word is new to me, but it's ringing bells in my brain right now, which basically means you find rejection very difficult to process.
That certainly rings true of you, Vic.
Yeah,
I would say me, but that has really got you hammered down. In one slogan.
I am crazy when it comes to this topic, Hamish. Anyway.
As we know, humans are also social animals, which makes rejection all the more emotionally painful. Research also shows that rejection triggers the same brain pathways that are activated when we experience physical pain.
Interesting, hey?
How much do you enjoy researching this one?
I love it because it's all about me again. It's me, Hamish. Yeah.
This is very much your episode.
Me.
I've never experienced it. I've just nothing but acceptance in my life, so I can't
lie
to this.
That is a lie. I know you sit crying by your phone at night.
Every girl I've ever approached has leapt into my arms.
Basically, what that means is rejection hurts as much as being kicked in the gonads.
Not so much about you, though.
No, that's more about me. You, yeah.
Although, what's it like being kicked in the tits?
Not very nice being kicked in the tits, I can assure you. We have invited a guest on today to explain rejection. We could phone him up and tell him not to come, though, couldn't we?
That would be phenomenal. Should we no-show?
Let's no-show. Yeah, see how he feels. We want to find out why it cuts so deep and why humans have a flight or fight response when the tribe turns their backs. But before we meet David, let's just share some of the times we felt rejected, Hamish. I imagine you were always picked last when it came to every sports event. How did that feel?
I'm actually pretty good at sport. I'm actually one of the not the last ones to get picked.
Don't believe it.
Rejection in my life. So I had a similar story to you with a friend. So you had a group of friends that rejected you. I had one friend that was my best friend at prep school. And then we went on to our next school. Never answered my text. Ever again.
I remember this story from our friends episode, didn't we?
Friends.
It's a similar... Friends. Hamish has got friends.
Rejection friends. Yes. So he was my best friend. And then he cut me off.
Yeah.
He went to Eton, so I blamed Eton. So I went to a posh school.
I blame Eton as well, yeah.
So I blame Eton. I would say every girl I ever fancied until I was about 21.
Yep, fair enough.
I was, you're the guy that we marry, not the one that we date when we're 14.
It's true though, Hamish, you are that guy.
I'm marriage material.
You are marriage material.
I am not fun for a fuck.
No.
I'm not that guy.
You are not that guy.
I wasn't cool enough. I said too much. The cool ones are the quiet ones. I said too much. I didn't smoke and drink enough.
I was going to say you weren't mean enough. The girls like the bad boy, don't they, at that age?
I was the crying shoulder.
Oh, yeah. God. So the wet blanket.
I was that guy. I got a lot of rejection from that. They were probably my biggest two. You know, sport, I was sort of okay at school.
Yeah.
School, a lot of people have bad experiences at school. Because I wasn't the best or worst looking, and I wasn't the best or worst at sport.
Mm.
I got an all-round scholarship at school, which meant I was just okay at music, I was okay at theatre, I was okay at being friends of everyone. I was like your average man again.
God.
Back to the normal drinker. I was just the normal guy. So I was sat right in the middle. So
right.
I was actually okay with rejection.
I think what you're saying there is that you kept kind of just underexposed. Is that correct?
Which is unlike me.
Which is unlike you now, because you're not like that anymore. Whereas
I'm
went extreme friendship. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just I had one mate. I had the best friends in the whole world. And they were going to be my best friends forever.
Yes.
And I imagined us in a nursing home going mad together. And we were always going to be tight. So that's a lot of pressure on other people, I realise now. Like you, it was probably safer for you to be mates with everybody and have these kind of nice acquaintances and it could come and go. Whereas I was like, these are my best friends and this is how I do friendship. Mm. And I am loyal and I am this and I am that. Which sets you up for failure almost, because then I'm going to be massively hurt when I do feel that level of rejection.
I think this has sort of come up a few times between you and I.
Yes.
I seem to just sort of passively pass through life, and I feel like you were thinking about stuff a lot. It wasn't just like, you're my friend. You were fantasizing the next 60 years of friendship together.
Yeah.
And then obviously, when you fall, it hurts a lot more falling from that height.
I'm doing that about you, you know.
Is it?
Yes. Yeah,
where do we retire to?
It's you, me and John and Liz in a retirement home.
That sounds lovely.
Yeah, together.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm okay with that.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Don't feel rejected if I don't die on your arms.
Hamish, we are going to be best friends forever, aren't
we? That's the deal. I've got a contract.
Surely that's what this is all about.
Otherwise, this is a waste of time.
Yeah, what's the point?
What's the point in investing time in friendships that don't last a lifetime?
I mean, that's how fucking mental I am, okay? I'm not as bad as I was, but I still find friendships very, very tricky to navigate because of my fear of rejection from the tribe, which stems from my mates leaving me at school.
Do you want to tell us some of your lowlights? Some of the highlights of your rejections, or do we call them lowlights? What should we call them? Your top five rejections?
Well, a local friend up here, when I gave up drinking, never spoke to me again.
Yeah.
I never explained why. So I find it very hard. Like, fair enough if you've gone off me. I don't mind that. That's, I can cope with. But just tell me. Just tell me that it's done so that I don't message you. I don't invite you anywhere anymore. Not telling me is extremely painful because I just carry on. I don't know that I've been rejected.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm like, hey, what are you up to? Oh, I didn't get a text back from you. Where are you?
Me again. Outside your front door, selfie. Yeah.
Oh, I'm just sitting in my car for 12 hours outside your house at night.
Yeah, that is their issue, not yours. That is nasty.
I know, but I would like people to tell me. Like, that's the thing. Just tell me what's going on. I'm very much a talker and I'm happy to listen to people's emotions, whether they're happy or sad. And if someone said, I'm sorry, this isn't working for me anymore, see you later, fine.
Would you be fine? If I call you and think, I'm in the process of rejecting you, I think I've got another 1 or 2 weeks and then you're out, how would you actually deal with that phone call?
I think I would put myself on a psych ward for the 2 weeks leading up to the rejection.
You've got 30 more days.
Yeah.
If you really impress me, I'll give you another month. Otherwise, you're out.
Yeah. I would need a team of therapists around me when that actually happened.
I don't know if you'd be as okay as you think with that phone call.
I wouldn't. You're 100% right. Boyfriends, when I got dumped, I always felt obviously very rejected and very hurt and always blamed myself, which is coming up a lot, isn't it? So I seem to blame myself when I get rejected.
But you were the dumper more than the dumpee, weren't you?
No, I reckon it was 50-50.
Was it?
Yeah.
See, but I was pretty much 100-0 in that front.
Yeah, you were the dumpee, that's for sure.
We've talked about this before, Hamish, which we must cover very quickly. We think that part of our fear of rejection is something to do with our English manners. We have a way with people, don't we, where we expect the same level of manners that we deliver, which again sets us up for failure. Yeah. Like if I invite someone over to my house, I will cook you a meal and I'll get the drinks, alcohol free, of course. And then if someone doesn't invite me back, I'm like, well, what the fuck's going on here?
It doesn't sit well with me, this idea that a relationship can fizzle out.
Yes.
I'm not okay with that. And I understand that you can't have the same amount of friends as you have at school for the rest of your life, but I still don't like the idea of like, oh yeah, we used to be friends and now we're not.
Yeah, I don't either.
I'll just send check-up texts, you know, like 12 months after we've never spoken, just to make sure we're still
sort
of base level. We're still okay.
Do you still like me?
Yeah, not quite that text. Yeah, I thought of you and this funny thing happened. Sometimes I won't get an answer.
I've written before, are we okay?
Oh, no. I wouldn't be okay receiving that text.
Oh, it's embarrassing, isn't it? Anyway, so I have this thing, Hamish, where I host parties, which again is going to set me up for rejection from the tribe. So I'm going to talk to our guest about it a bit later on in the podcast. But recently I've organised a Halloween party. I've invited 26 kids. I've only had 4 or 5 responses from the beautiful printed invite that I spent a lot of money sending out.
Did you?
Yes.
Were they 3D? Were they like spiders popping out of it and stuff?
It wasn't quite 3D, but it was pretty good. Yeah, so I feel rejected by people. And I don't even know these people because they're just people from the kindy. So I feel rejected already by people that I don't even know.
Yeah.
And that makes me feel anxious.
Well, you were going to talk about the fact that when you organise a party, the people that don't turn up sting more than the victory of the ones turning up.
Yeah, so I can't enjoy the people that are with me because I'm so concerned about the people that have rejected me, which is fucked up. So I'm hoping that David's going to cure me by the end of this podcast.
I think that is his job in this podcast.
I do. That's why I've invited him on.
Is this just a recorded therapy session?
It basically is, yeah.
That conversation should be having behind closed doors.
I'm not sure why I feel rejection so deeply. I guess it stems from that situation at school somewhere along the line, but I'm not really sure.
We should interview those girls
episode. No thanks. I don't want to see them again.
That would be good stuff.
The funny thing is that I don't really want to go to the parties that I get rejected from anyway.
Yeah.
So even if someone's invited me to a barbecue or something, I don't really want to go. But if they don't invite me, then I do want to go. Yeah. I actually walk past the park sometimes, Hamish. Here we go. This is a terrible...
God. This is going to be an overshare.
This is going to be a total overshare. And I look. So there's often parties. This is bad.
This is desperate.
Yeah, this is desperate.
In my head, you're driving past, the windows down, like 2 miles an hour. You're in fancy dress, just in case.
Just in case. So if I take the dog for a walk, right, and there's a party at the park, all the local parties happen at the park down where I live, I do a skim past just to see.
With a wrapped present.
Just to see if it's a party of someone that I know and I haven't been invited to it. So I'm going to see if I've been rejected.
Is that what happened when I was down at the park for my work drinks and you showed up and sang us Christmas carols? Were you doing walk by?
I don't remember that, but probably, yes.
Yeah.
I was like, what's going on here? Oh, Hamish, you're having a party. Ding dong merrily on high.
Hamish, I know Lani, I know 2 people. Why am I not invited? It's work drinks. Everyone here works for the same company. Please stop singing Christmas carols at us.
I just can't bear the thought of it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that is a lot to share.
I am very insecure about friendships, basically, Hamish, is what it is.
Hang on, I'm not past this one yet. Do you, if you do see that it is people that you know, do you sort of stroll past like, hey, what are you guys doing here?
Yep.
Okay, so you don't come home and cry and be like those bastards.
No, I go and mingle and say, hey guys, you having a party?
Guys, what the hell?
Yeah.
Hey, how
it
awkward.
Just so happens I've got some party poppers in my back pocket. I can make this a good time.
Oh, gosh. I have sometimes found myself, without meaning to, saying to people that just got married who I wasn't invited to the wedding, I'd be like, I'm so sorry I couldn't make the wedding. And then there's this awkward silence of like, they know I wasn't invited. I've just realised I wasn't invited. I'm like, move on, next conversation.
That's like when someone says hello and you go, I'm fine, thank you. I think rejection can make me feel worthless. It's a horrible, like the feeling that it gives me, and it's the one thing, I really suffer with it.
Yeah.
And I, especially when my hormones are playing up, I suffer even worse, which is one of the reasons I'm handing Hamish over to do a lot of our interviews now. It's the same thing. It's fear of rejection. So when we interviewed Lee Mack, for example, I just get nervous because I don't want to be rejected, or I don't want somebody who's famous to think I'm a twat.
Right.
So therefore, it's the same thing. It's like rejection from the tribe. So it's a lot of what my anxiety is about, is this topic. Mm-hmm. It's funny, Haim, in our list here, I have so many more points than you. That's because in general, actually, women experience rejection more strongly than men. This is because women are often more socially inclined and prioritise social relationships more than men. As a result, rejection in relationships may be more intense for women.
I know at school the girls did seem to change friendship groups more often than us lads, but I wonder if that's because men hide their emotions more. I know I wouldn't make a fuss if I was rejected from a group of mates. I would just pretend to be okay because I'm from a just-keep-your-chin-up generation that never really complained. I feel a lot of men feel it too, but we're less inclined to talk as openly about that feeling. I can't think of any conversation I've ever had with any man who's been like, I wasn't invited to Diane's birthday and I'm really struggling with the emotions of that feeling. That's never happened. People are more like, well, I didn't give a shit anyway. I didn't want to go. It's a bunch of losers.
Yeah.
That's about as far as the emotional conversation about rejection went with any bloke I've ever spoken to.
Isn't that funny? Because when I meet up with my mates, we're like, oh, did you hear that Little didn't get invited to the party? What do you mean I didn't get invited? Like, what's going on there?
Okay, so I reckon men, and then, you know, that's only my experience of men, I would say that men feel that rejection of a group of friends less. I think the only time we really feel rejection is probably in a romantic relationship.
Okay, yeah.
Like, because it's very clear, we used to go out and now she doesn't want to go out with me, therefore it's rejection. Whereas not being invited to a party, you can tell yourself a few stories as to why. Oh, I'm sure they're just limited on numbers. Mm. Oh, I'm sure if it was just friends and family and I'm a plus one, you know. I reckon you can sort of lie to yourself to make yourself feel better.
Yeah, so that's good. So you're going in there with a positive frame of mind going, well, it's not my issue that I haven't been invited.
Yeah.
It's a mistake that somebody else has made, because why wouldn't you want me at the party?
Exactly.
I love that, Hamish.
Idiot wouldn't invite me to the party?
Well, that's how I feel about myself. So therefore, I'm like, come on, guys, I'm a good laugh.
Okay, so your rejection fear does not come out of insecurity. No. It comes out of
overconfidence. Overconfidence. Yeah. What the fuck's wrong with you? Why wouldn't you want me at a party?
You freak. Why would you not invite me? It's clearly a better party with me there.
I'm the best. Now, recently, I met a bloke called Dave.
Disco Dave?
Yeah.
The Disco Dave.
Not Disco Dave from the intro, no. But he's not far off. It was a bit of a random meeting. Dave emailed me and said he liked meeting interesting people and wanted to catch up for a coffee.
Did he say, you must have got the wrong person, but I'll introduce you to Hamish?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, it's the other one on the podcast you want to speak to.
Yeah.
I'm the one who talks about tea all the
time. All right. My husband does sometimes get a bit nervy when I pop off to meet strange men in parks, but luckily I'm as loyal as a sheepdog, Hamish. And Dave wasn't a weirdo. In fact, he was one of the most interesting people I've met in ages. Dave and I sat in the park with a coffee and put the world to rights one Tuesday morning, and I've been trying to find an excuse to get him on the podcast, and this is the perfect topic because it's something he knows all about.
In recent years, David embarked on a personal journey of self-discovery, uncovering a profound purpose that ignites his soul, inspiring individuals to make a positive impact on the world. For the past 15 years, David has directed his focus on the world of neuroscience leadership, and today he stands proudly as the director and lead coach of his company, NeuroLead.
It's now his passion and life's mission to help individuals uncover this potential and harness the incredible power within themselves. I heard a quote recently and it struck a nerve, reminding me of the conversation we had in the park that morning. Evolution has programmed us to feel rejection in our guts, and I know that's where I feel it. This is how the tribe enforced obedience. Fear of rejection isn't psychological, it's biological. It's in our cells. What do you think about this? Is rejection really biological?
I firmly believe there's an unconscious need to fit in. And if we take a step back and look at our brains, right, they're the prediction machine of the brain. Our brain hasn't evolved in thousands and thousands of years. So if we understand that, that is the way our brain looks at a modern world. You know, back in the day where there was prehistoric creatures and other people that were going to hunt and kill and, you know, take all our stuff, in a modern world it's completely different. The brain is wired to do one of three things: maximize reward, minimize threat, and conserve energy. So we're going to focus on the minimizing threat to start with. And if I look at the threat, I look at two types of pain. One is physical pain and one is social pain. So the physical pain is simply cuts, bruises, bumps, you know, knock your head. When you learned to ride a bike and you fell off your bike, did that stop you from riding it again?
No, but I don't ride one anymore because I feel too uncomfortable. But as a kid, I definitely got back on.
Yeah. And what's your thoughts? Do you think that physical pain or the fear of physical pain holds you back from achieving things?
Not really. I mean, it depends what it is. I recently tried wakeboarding and I felt like my arms were going to fall off and I decided never to do it again. Yeah. I do think as I get older, I am starting to avoid things that would cause me physical pain.
When I used to live in the Northern Territory, I would go for a jog with my wife, tripped over a bit of concrete, face planted, took skin off my hands and knees. But you know what? I kept on jogging. I went back the next day. It didn't hold me back from achieving personal success or trying to attain my goals. So physical pain, a lot of people understand it, feel it, can recognize how it doesn't hold you back.
Yeah.
Then I want to dive into social pain. So social pain is the fear of exclusion. So remember, our brains haven't evolved in thousands of years. And the fear of exclusion comes from our need, our evolutionary need to conform with our tribe. You know, thousands of years ago, you might have lived in a tribe. What would happen if you were excluded or cast away from that tribe?
I would die, I should think, in those days.
Yeah, 100%, you're right.
Yeah.
If you're cast away from the tribe, you lose the ability for security, food, comfort, shelter, and ultimately cast away and probably a long, painful death. So that evolutionary fear of exclusion is still deep within our brain. And our brain processes, you know, thousands of bits of information every second, and it's looking for that threat of exclusion, which is that social pain. And to the point where that when you experience exclusion, when you have when you're feeling that social pain, that exclusion, your brain creates something called an episodic memory. And that episodic memory is a memory with feeling attached.
Right.
And it does something else as well, which is remarkable. It actually turns the pain up. So when you're exposed to a situation that's very similar or you're getting triggered, it actually magnifies the pain that was felt, which is leading to you to go, I'm about to get excluded, I need to do A, B, and C. So if the brain does that, that's an incredible feat of engineering from the brain's point of view. If the brain didn't think that exclusion was important, why would it do that?
Yeah, it's trying to protect you, I guess.
Exactly right. So, and that's with everything you do, whether it's someone walking down the street, you're having a conversation with someone, how you read an email, everything. It is always looking out for threat.
That's so interesting because I know as a sober person, one of the biggest fears that I had when giving up drinking was exclusion. And now that I have been sober for 5.5 years, I'm not so afraid of it, but I still feel it. Mm. You weren't here for our intro. Me and Hamish had a chat about me organising parties and about how I feel this huge rejection if people don't turn up. And in fact, I spend the whole party not enjoying myself with the people that have kindly shown up and thinking about the ones that haven't. And it's like this self-torture that I do. And I know it's related to a situation at school when I turned up to meet my two best friends and they never spoke to me again. And I know that everything that I do is related to that moment. It was the one thing that came up in therapy for me, which was my trauma. Mm. And now I hate going back to that moment because obviously it's the one thing I want to forget. But it's like, you know, my body keeps a score. My body remembers that moment and it takes me back there all the time. It is so annoying. So sober people, I think, particularly feel rejection a lot because we don't get invited to as many things. We do feel like people think we're boring. What do you have to say about it in relation to sobriety?
If I look at, I had a great conversation with a young lady that my family and I met the other day, and she's a massive advocate for not drinking and being the best version of herself. But what we spoke about is that if you look at your evolutionary urge to fit in, alcohol is something that everyone can do. Doesn't matter religion, creed, belief, financial status, hierarchical status. Everyone has the ability to drink. And that actually forms this common interest, but a really short bond. Because once you stop drinking, that also peels away. Very much like AFL footy. I grew up in Victoria. Mm. And if you followed footy, you could have a conversation with a CEO. You could have a conversation with someone that just walked into a shop or down the street. It creates this common interest for everyone. So if I looking at sobriety and the fear of being excluded, it's understanding that you know, why am I feeling that draw to this group of people, and why am I feeling this fear of being excluded from this group of people on something that could simply be a common interest that comes and goes, you know, as long as you're drinking.
I guess we're sort of drawn to this tribal mentality, aren't we? It's in our nature to want to be part of something.
What I find is a lot of people don't necessarily have a why or a purpose in life. And if we can link that back to values and, you know, way we carry ourselves, you know, to live the life that we want to live, so we don't get to a point, you know, when we're at the end of our life and we regret things. There's a gentleman by the name of Stephen Covey. So he wrote a book called Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Awesome read. I would highly recommend reading it, especially chapter 2. And if you're time poor, chat GPT summary.
Okay, great.
You'll get it. That's fine. But I'm going to paraphrase it now. But in a sense, what he does is he gets you to cast your mind out to your funeral. You're sitting at your funeral, you're surrounded by friends, family, and loved ones, and he gets you to do the work as in, okay, what do I want to feel? What do I want to hear? When my mum and dad stand up and have that, speaking about that eulogy, what do I want the word, what do I want to hear, what do I want to feel, what legacy, you know, did I leave? And our brains, as I was saying before, they're built to survive right now. They're built to survive for the next, you know, seconds, hours, and maybe by the end of the day. Mm. They're not designed to think long term. Doing the planning work and the strategy work is really challenging, but what will really transform your mindset, starting the journey yourself, is what do I want that to be? Mm. You know, do I want to be remembered for someone that was inspirational, genuine care, empathetic, compassionate, gave time to people when they needed it? Or was this that bloke that I knew at the pub, or destroyed relationships, or A or B or C? Because when you start doing that long-term thinking work, it's hard. And you've got to do that. You've got to peel back those layers, yeah, you know, to create this new version of yourself. And I think once you've done that, you're like, okay, that won't eliminate that fear or that fear of social exclusion, but that's a start, right? Because you've got a goal, you've got an end in mind that you need to do. So once you've got those values, how do I behave between right now and that end to get there? So I think moving on from that, you've also got to understand, okay, I'm going to be faced with these challenges. I'm going to be faced with a social situation where I want to be the best version of myself. I don't want to drink anymore, or I don't want to eat junk food anymore. I'm on a clean diet. That's okay. What am I going to do when I'm faced with that situation?
I think we spend a lot of time appeasing other people, don't we? Like, I would go into that situation, and sometimes I just go because I think people expect me to, whereas I don't have a lot of boundaries around things. Whereas, in fact, sometimes I was saying to Hamish before, sometimes I don't want to go to things. The things that I'm not getting invited to, I don't want to go to them anyway. So it's just this part of me that feels like there's expectations of me and that I have to do this and I have to continue being social, even though sometimes I don't want to be. But my brain is still telling me to do the things I don't want to do. And sometimes I feel like I don't have control over my actions. And I think sometimes it's really hard for sober people because we want to continue going out, but yet we find it hard. That's the truth of it. In the first few years, going out, being social, and being that one person there that isn't drinking is hard because everyone else is off on a different planet than us. The vibe's not the same. They don't want to sit and have like authentic conversations like we are now. They want to dance, repeat the same thing over and over again, and it can just feel really, really uncomfortable. And I know that it's my brain telling me, don't go into that situation. So it's actually my brain protecting me. It's really clear now that you've just said that, because I can feel that I am trying to protect myself, but sometimes I go against what my brain is telling me. Why do I do that?
So there's a neuroscience understanding about two types of thought. You've got the unconscious thought of the brain, which is rapid fire, 1,000 bits of information using your past experience to build a prediction, to maximize reward, minimize threat, conserve energy. Right. But now you've also got that ability to layer context on that situation. When our brains evolved thousands of years ago, that's what happened. We created an executive function, executive thinking, which gave us the ability to layer context over the primitive thought processes, which is, I must be part of that group or I will die.
Yeah.
Where you can actually go, well, hang on, I don't think we need to do that, brain. I appreciate you protecting me from something that you think I could die from, but based on my understanding of what's happening, that's okay if I don't go to that social event. So there's another term I'd like to introduce. It's called social conformity. And I want to take a step back. If you can understand the simple basics of neuroscience, especially neuroscience leadership on how your brain works so you can lead yourself, it will completely change your life forever. Challenging because it gives you the key to, you know, achieve anything you want. But if you just understand the little bits and pieces of it and start observing and labeling, it will completely change the way you look at the world.
So what you're saying there is that you need to take a step back from your own thought process. Is that correct?
Yeah, in a sense. So that prediction part of your brain is rapid fire. It's happening in an unconscious fashion, 24/7, thousands of bits of information, decisions. And a lot of them you don't even know that's happening. It's called cognitive dissonance, but I like to label it as deceptive brain messages. And you need to be looking for these deceptive brain messages. Here's a great example. Me starting my journey on self, love peanut butter on toast.
Yeah.
It was my absolute comfort food. Like I could smash 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pieces. If I had a hard day at work, I would come home. Mm. Where's the peanut butter? Where's the toast? I'm like, I don't want to do that anymore. But when I was in the kitchen and one of my twin daughters would be cooking some toast, my brain was like, bang, money, you need that. But then understanding neuroscience and my brain's there to, you know, maximize reward, which is peanut butter on toast, releases a thing called dopamine. I was able to go, deceptive brain message, I don't want to eat the peanut butter on toast. I don't need the peanut butter on toast and I'm going to walk away.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, Vic, do you think you might have ADHD?
Well, listeners keep emailing me, telling me that they think I do, so probably.
Mind you, listeners also email us saying we talk too much about your mum's feet, so what do they know?
Yeah, fair enough.
I honestly had no idea about the connection between overdrinking and ADHD until we started this podcast.
About 40% of people that have had any sort of drinking issues also apparently have ADHD.
Whenever we chat to ex-drinkers, this comes up more than you'd believe. If you have ADHD or suspect you might, or just want to learn about this link, then we would encourage you to check out the I Have ADHD podcast.
It's the place where adults with ADHD find research-based information, validation, and tons of support.
This is the best way to feel less alone and hear some of the answers to the questions you've been sitting with for too long. You'll hear detailed descriptions of what it means to have ADHD and enjoy interviews with the foremost experts in the industry so that you don't have to read those ADHD books that are collecting dust on your shelf.
Yeah. Listen to the I Have ADHD podcast and learn how ADHD affects every aspect of your life, from the boardroom to the bedroom.
In the podcast, you'll also hear about their ADHD coaching program, which is called Focused. Focused is made up of three pillars: courses, coaching, and community. It is designed to help you build your own self-improvement program and is perfect for the ADHD brain.
And you can get $50 off the course just by using the code SOBER, S-O-B-E-R. So if you're tired of feeling stuck and don't know where to start, listen to the I Have ADHD podcast.
You could say a craving is a deceptive brain message.
Without a doubt.
So I remember when I was a drinker, I'd come home, the kids were acting crazy, I'd have that reward wine at the end of the day because I would tell myself that that was going to make me feel better. Of course it didn't, because I had two or three and then felt like shit and had a hangover the next day. But my brain was always giving me these deceptive messages that alcohol, because of my environment and my culture and everything that's ever happened to me in my life, my brain, it felt like it was wired to lean on alcohol anytime anything went wrong. But now, of course, I've adjusted my brain chemistry. Yep. I've rewired myself to go, no, sometimes I might look at a cold beer and go, oh, that looks nice. But then I sit with that moment, I sit with that thought and address that deceptive message and go, oh, actually, I know that's not good for me. It's just my brain telling me that because that's what it's used to doing. What you're saying, Dave, is that we can maybe rewire our brains a little bit if we delve a little bit further into the thought.
There's another term I'll introduce, but I won't go into it too much because it might sound a bit scary, but it's called neuroplasticity. So it's your ability to rewire your brain, but that takes focused attention time and time again. And you can 100% rewire your brain to do anything you want. Like you can learn several languages, you can build a house, you can become an astronaut, you can do whatever you want if you have that focus. But fighting those deceptive brain messages is so hard to the point where, put it in perspective, the human brain is an untapped resource and considered the most powerful processing machine known to mankind.
Yep.
So you've got that in your corner to achieve whatever you want, but it's got a very strict understanding. It's got a strict agenda to maximize reward, minimize threat, conserve energy. Unless you've got something to trump that, it is going to dive you into one of those three things.
Okay.
So if you're looking at peanut butter on toast like I was, incredibly, like it's almost like a sense of overwhelm that I'm getting drawn to this toast when I shouldn't be drawn to this toast. I'm like, why do I love this toast? I don't want the toast. But if I link it back to values, behaviors within those values, nice, solid goals, that gives you something to lean back on.
Totally. Yeah. It's very interesting how our own behavior, I remember before I gave up drinking, I just thought, well, this is the way I am. I'm a drinker. I'm like my family. I like to party. This is who I am as a person. This is my identity. And we did an episode recently called Reputation Party Animal. And it was about how we create our identities and that creates a reputation. And then you keep repeating behaviors because that's what's expected of you. And of course, I've proved that I'm not that person now. For someone that's listening, how would you bring this notion of changing into your everyday personal life?
For me, you've just got to start to observe what you're doing and ask yourself the question, why am I doing that? You know, if I'm craving peanut butter on toast, why? I just had food. Like, do I need that? And once you observe it, you have that ability to label it, right? But it's very much like a muscle. I like to refer to the brain as a muscle where you go to the gym one day, you come back home, you look at yourself in the mirror, there's no change. Yeah. But you've got to have faith that the results will come. And a lot of people don't even like calling the word out deceptive messages, but out of all the workshops I do, I always make that very, very impactful. So people feel comfortable if they're in their kitchen or they're in their garage or driving to work and they pass a Macca sign, it's like, oh, I love a soft serve cone. Deceptive brain message.
Yeah, right.
Because that will pass, right? And that's probably the biggest message is understanding the natural evolutionary drivers of your brain, which aren't necessarily relevant to today's society.
Yeah.
And then you've got to realize that is what my behaviors or what my urges are or what my brain's trying to get me to do, is it actually reality? Does that fit into my current reality? And if not, you've got the ability to regulate. But again, it's like going to the gym or even, you know, I want to run a marathon. You just can't get up one morning and expect to run the marathon. You've got to have that focus, that commitment. And that starts with the values, the end in mind, how I carry myself with my goals. And when you become a values-based person and you've got goals and behaviors and you know who you are, and if you're lucky enough to understand your purpose in life, that's just like, you know, five stars. But what you'll find is that when you conform with the majority of the population, it feels good, right? But the connection's quite shallow. And we're drawn into that connection because we've got common interests like football and, you know, alcohol, drugs, whatever it is. We can socially conform with anyone as long as we do what they're doing. And if 99% of the world's population is doing the same thing, odds are we're going to do the same thing. But when you start doing that future work, those values, behaviors, goals, you're like, hang on, for me to get to there, I've got to do something different. Am I ready for that? Once you break away from that conformity, it is an incredibly lonely place. But you need to feel that loneliness to connect to why you're doing things. And once you embrace that loneliness should be a badge of honor. That exclusion should be a badge of honor because you are doing what you want to do to live the best life you possibly can. You're going to have these deceptive brain messages saying, just have a beer, just do this, just break the law, just do this, just eat that hamburger one time when you shouldn't be because it's not your goal to do that. But once you start moving further and further away, what happens is you start meeting like-minded people. And this connection with like-minded people is unbelievably rewarding, unbelievably deep, and the conversations are more than just the shallow emptiness of a common interest, which might be football. Yeah. Love football, not saying that, common interest, or alcohol or smoking or whatever it is.
I find it absolutely fascinating because what you're describing there is the sober journey for everybody. In the beginning, it's very, very lonely because you're excluding yourself from the tribe. And then you have to find your individuality. And that is isolating because you're making yourself different from everybody else. So I went through 18 months of not telling anybody that I'd given up drinking because of my fear of exclusion. And then over time, it's exactly what you've been saying. Yeah. Like it is in line with everything that happens to anyone that gives up drinking, is that you find people, you find your community, you find your tribe again, which is going to be people that like to have conversations like we do, that sit in the park and have a coffee and put the world to rights. You will start finding people that have the same interests as you and that don't have one level conversations about what beer you like or who won at the football. And it's so fascinating how much deeper your relationships become, not only when you go on a journey of self, but also in a journey of giving up drinking, which is also the journey of the self, you will find out. I thought giving up alcohol was just about giving up alcohol. Now I drink, now I don't drink, that was it. But what you'll discover, what everyone out there will discover, that it's not about that at all. It starts off with you being kinder to yourself, and you start to push yourself out of your comfort zone and you start to live your life to the fullest. And I think, Dave, what you're saying is going on this journey of the self like you have done, it allows you to see the world out of the narrow perspective, beyond the periphery of your normal vision, and to see the world as you want it. Is that correct?
Without a doubt. And if I can, even when I met you in the park, and I think my opening line to Vic was, listen, I'm not a creeper. Don't, it's okay. But for me, I openly source those types of connections because the shallow connections, right, they're there. You need them all the time to get any type of feeling of community or connection, you know. But when I have the ability to meet with people like yourself and talk about the world, right, and at the end of the day, once I have that conversation with yourself or people like-minded, that gives me a hit for weeks. Like I can actually be home by myself, working at home, traveling around, and that is feeding from that energy. Mm-hmm. And unless you find those like-minded people, you're never going to get that energy. And if you look at some of the most successful, famous people, whether they're sports stars, movie stars, whatever they are, they'll go through the ups and downs, just like we will. They'll go through the materialistic stuff, the money stuff. At the end, they all link it back to servanthood. Humans getting the best out of humans to have a positive impact on the world. So if you can do that work in your journey of becoming sober, you know, you're fast tracking, finding out, you know, you're learning lessons that successful people, you know, they get to the point of taking their own life, discover servanthood, discover how amazing deep connection is, giving back without the fear of, you know, getting anything in return. That is the epitome of human joy. You just need to find what part of the world that is for you. But once you're there, you won't even look back at conforming socially. You'll actually look back and it's like, wow, I am without a doubt 100% proud of who I am as a person. And I know I'm going to get to that end in mind.
Yep.
And I'm going to leave the legacy. I'm going to be kind, caring, generous, passionate, empathetic, and live the, you know, the best life I possibly can. Because if you're looking after yourself, that gives you the ability to look after others as well.
Yeah. I think we talk a lot on this podcast about reframing our social lives when you get sober. And I think we're almost stuck in this traditional, that's been going on for maybe 100 years, traditional form of socializing, which is going out somewhere and being with mates and drinking and partying. And that's what we consider fun nowadays. And that's what's thrown at us by the media and everywhere we look is, this is how you have fun. But now the most rewarding social event for me is going to my exercise group at 5:15 in the morning and having a swim and a coffee with the ladies afterwards. I get my hit of dopamine. I get my conversations out of the way. We laugh all morning and I'm done. And like you, that feeds me. Even if I go once a week, which I try and go more, I promise, I get fed by that for the whole week. I've had my social interaction. It was really positive. I'm not searching out any other events that I'm probably not going to enjoy because I know who my people are. And that is something that everybody needs to do, is perhaps look at this in a way, look, are you just conforming and going out in a traditional sense to appease other people? Or can you reframe those social situations so that it fits with your self-help?
There's an interesting lens you can put on that where, and a lot of people would have heard this token saying, where you've got to surround yourself with people. So you become your environment. And from a neuroscience point of view, that makes complete sense. But you've got to surround yourself with the people that get the best out of you. And this isn't always going to be your closest friends and family. You can still love them and care for them, and they can still love and care for you, but you need to source out those people that are going to push, make you uncomfortable, to be the best versions of yourselves. Because if you don't do that, you're always naturally going to conform back with, you know, social conformity with society. But there's another interesting lens where, you know, from a threat point of view of exclusion, you've got, I don't want to exclude myself from the tribe, but then I'm also fearful of finding a new tribe.
Yeah.
If I go find a new tribe, what are they going to say about me? What are they going to think about me? You know, are they going to exclude me? Am I going to be welcome? But again, if you have those values, goals, behaviors, perspectives are key, right? If you start introducing yourselves into those uncomfortable situations where you're values-based, you're meeting with like-minded people, it actually starts to rewire the brain. It rewires the give-up mechanism of the brain to go, hey, this isn't as scary as I thought it would be. I get the pleasure of working with a diverse range of people, and I try to think, okay, how can I get what I know into the perspective of everyone? There's people like engineers and, you know, people that love chemistry and physics and all that type of stuff. So the physics definition of momentum is, to get object A moving, it takes X amount of energy. But once object A is moving, that energy required is extremely low once you're moving. Very much like achieving personal success, the hardest bit is starting. But once you've started, that energy, that effort, that discipline is so much less, because you're seeing results, you're achieving things, you're meeting new people, you're going into new social situations where you're not being excluded. It's like, wow, that person's amazing and they don't drink. You know, and then that starts to get that momentum up, and all of a sudden you're in this new life, you're loving it, you're finding these deep connections, you're getting the dopamine wherever you go, you're hunting them out, and you're actually potentially influencing other people to make the change, because people are seeing what you're doing and it's like, I want a bit of that. And then you start bringing those people on the journey as well. And that's how you start building your mini tribe. You start building a tribe where people feel safe, they feel comfortable, they feel included, they feel that their values and behaviours and goals are in line with, you know, a good end in mind.
It's funny you mentioned that, because we just did an episode a couple of weeks ago about creating your sober tribe, like finding your people. It's one of the most satisfying things I've ever did, was to start a sober breakfast group. It took ages. It was very uncomfortable at first, but now the same people come every month and we just sit and we talk and we're like-minded and we end up just laughing. My face hurts when I come away from those, because it's just such a pleasure to be amongst people who understand you. And that's very difficult when you're sober, especially going out into what you'd call a normal social event.
If you can understand why you don't want to do something, and let's link it to drinking, right? If you understand, okay, this is why I don't want to drink because of A, B, and C. There's an incredibly powerful connection tool called vulnerability. And if you Google it, there's a lady called Brené Brown, industry leader, superstar.
We love her. We quote her a lot.
Yeah. There's a short little video about a little bear in a manhole, and I'll Google it, it's sensational. But when you understand what you need to do to be the best version of yourself, and you go back into that social environment, which you would consider your tribe, vulnerability is opening yourself up, knowing that you could be excluded, right? Incredibly powerful tool. So I would challenge anyone, if you want to make that decision, stop drinking, change behaviors, whatever it is, go to your tribe and share with them exactly that. But you need to be able to talk to it, right? Let them know, whether it's a team, a family, a group of friends, a community group, go, listen, I've made the decision to stop drinking. And I want to be a better person, not only for my family and friends, but also you. And I'm making that decision, if you can please support me.
Yeah, own it.
99% of people will say, wow, that is really powerful. Because it's, you know, an evolutionary urge to share and connect. But if they take the piss out of you or go, stop being an idiot, You got to ask another great question. Are these people actually wanting me to live my best life? Mm. Or are they just including me because I've got that common interest of booze?
Yeah. There's nothing more powerful, really, than seeing someone stand their ground.
Yep.
It's nothing more inspiring to me. I remember when we get up and do our live shows, Hamish always gets up there and he owns the stage, and I always feel really nervous before. But I know people don't want to see someone who's nervous get up on a stage. And he's really got this fantastic mindset of just walking into every situation and learning something from it. Recently, we've been doing quite a few interviews with famous people, and I've had to hand it over to Hamish because I can't hardly speak in front of a famous person. I get so bloody nervous. It's awful. How can I stop that brain messaging telling me that I'm not good enough in certain situations?
Looking at my self journey, that's going to take a while.
Hmm.
But if you have your, again, link it back to those values, right? If you have that end in mind, you have those values, those behaviors, and you carry yourself in a way that you are living the best life possible, in a sense, you become proud of yourself, right? Mm. And I'm a massive fan of positive affirmations, massive fan. I've probably got a list of 30 that I say every day, hopefully try and do every day. But the first statement I have is I love myself and I'm proud of who I am.
Yeah.
And I think if you just have that mindset, you've got to focus on that I need to do what's best for me. And what that happens is, and if you look at famous people, right, they're just humans. Mm-hmm. They have the ups and downs that we have as well. And they're looking for genuine connection. And I find the most genuine people are the people that are so content with who they are and what they do. They won't deviate for anyone. They won't deviate the way they carry themselves, what they drink, what they eat, the way they walk, the way they dress. They are 100% in control of their life, and they know exactly how to get from A to B, and they don't care who you are. And I think when you're that happy and content with yourself, any other human is just an interaction.
Yeah.
And you might even get to the point where it's like, you know what? Just because this person's famous, I'm not getting anything from this, right?
Yeah. I'm definitely questioning it. You know, I'm aware that I do it, and I wonder why. Yeah. I'm very curious about my own behaviours. So I think I'm reaching a point where I will get to the point where I'll just go, yeah, I'm going to own this. I am definitely questioning the way I behave a lot, which I'm all for learning all the time. Now, I know, Dave, that you are sober. Why?
If I really look back on my life, the most shameful behaviours, the most shameful thoughts, the way I've carried myself, the deepest hurt, the deepest memories I've got, which are attached to some type of pain, are all alcohol related. And for me, it's like, okay, I've got to stop it, right? Because it's not helping me be the best person I can be, and it's not helping my family, it's not helping my friends, and I've got to stop it. And there was this one moment, I went on a fishing trip in the Northern Territory, and looking back on it now, it's somewhat... it's disgusting in a way. I think over the Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I think I drank 60 beers, 10 rums and cokes, absolutely wrecked for a week. And I'm thinking, where am I?
Mm.
Like, what is this?
Yeah.
You know, like, what is this? Like, this is...
feels pointless, doesn't it?
This is ridiculous. Yeah. Like, that is, like, absolutely disgusting behaviour. Whether society think that's not disgusting or like, oh, yeah, man, you...
It's just booze doing what booze does, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's like there's a lot of shame around it, but it's designed for you to have more than one.
Yeah.
So it's not really your fault, and you do feel shame about it.
Oh.
But, of course, that's just the drug doing what the drug's supposed to do.
There's overwhelming studies, science, people, evidence. If one person tells you not to drink because of A, B, and C, you're like, ah, that's your agenda. You go do what you want, whatever. But if 1 million people told you... drinking is bad for you because of A, B, C, D, and E. Would you listen? And if it's not 1 million, how many is it?
Mm.
How many people does it take for you to go, you know what? Just because everyone has done it for the last how many hundreds of years, it doesn't mean I have to do it as well.
It's down to your individuality again, isn't it?
Exactly right.
Choosing what's right for you rather than what's right for everybody else.
One of the biggest shifts for me is saying I don't drink. So when someone says, hey, Dave, do you want a beer? I don't drink alcohol.
Mm.
And they're like, what? I said, I just don't drink. I'm never going to drink again in my life. It's so interesting the amount of positive responses that I get from people, right? People shake my hands like, man, I wish I could do that. I want to do that.
Yeah, well, you
can. It's like, well, why don't you?
Yeah.
But then also understanding, you know, having empathy and attempting to feel what they're feeling, they're in for an incredibly tough journey.
Mm.
But the journey... you know, it brings so much joy to your life.
Yeah.
And I say that to everyone. I don't care who it is. Like if a famous, successful person, my mum or my dad or my whoever it is, hey, Dave, you want a beer? No, no thanks, I don't drink anymore. And I remember a conversation I had with a really close friend of mine called Zen in Darwin. So he lives in Darwin, right? There's pretty much, it's religious. Drinking is a religion up there.
Mm.
And in and around my flights, I said, hey, mate, I've got a couple of hours in the airport. Do you want to catch up for a coffee? And I was talking to him about some stuff. And I said, man, I've given up drinking. I don't drink. I'm never going to drink ever again. Mm. And the look of, like, he was just so proud for me. And he now based on that, he's taken his time to reflect on his life.
Yeah.
And he's like, man, what? Why am I drinking?
Yeah. I think I've got 2 points there. The first one being is being loud and proud about your sobriety. Sometimes this isn't about you. Hamish says he doesn't talk about it that much, but I will tell someone within 5 minutes of meeting them because I know they want to tell me something. And often I can tell when someone's a big drinker. So I feel like if I say I don't drink, it gives them the opportunity to tell me that they're struggling with it. It's not coming from a, hey, look at me, I don't drink. Like when I say own it, I don't be like, yeah, be smug about it. I mean, tell someone because it gives them the opportunity to open up to a conversation like with your mate. And the second point there, I will share with you that I have booked myself to go into a psych to see a therapist next week. We talk about being worthy of support a lot on this podcast, and I think sometimes people just don't go because they don't feel like their problem's bad enough. But I have this thing, like I told you about, I'm fearing events that I should be looking forward to. All of the things that I do are my dream come true that I'm doing at the moment, yet I build up this fear within me that I don't want to do them. And I don't want to be that person anymore. So I've booked in next week to go and see a therapist and work out why I'm doing that to myself. And I recommend, like me and Dave are sat here, we don't drink, but we're not saying that solves everything. We're saying we're still curious and we're still finding ourselves and we are still worthy of extra support if we need it, and everybody out there is.
And it's even the fear of social pain. So you are worthy of professional support, but a lot of people don't do it because they're afraid to be excluded from the person they're getting support from.
Absolutely. That was one of my hugest fears when I phoned up the therapist. I said, hello, I'm just a bit of a binge drinker. I think I need help, like dampening my problem, thinking that she was going to go, oh, you're just a twitty mother who's a binge drinker. Whereas in fact, the lady on the other end of the line just went, you're perfect for this. See you Monday. And that's what will happen to you. There are people to deal with different levels of every problem. It doesn't matter how big or small it is.
Yep. Just to give your listeners a tool they can walk away with, or to put something in perspective. And I call it the $1 million mindset. When you're ever faced with something that you want to overcome, or a new behavior or an old behavior you're trying to get rid of, if you simply ask yourself, could I do this if I got $1 million for doing it? Because remember, your brain's wired for the now, the instant gratification, not long-term game. Could I give up drinking? Or could I go for a 1 kilometer run if $1 million was on the line?
Yep, you would.
And if you say yes, which 99% of people will, you have the knowledge,
yep,
the capability and the capacity to do anything. And if you say yes, that proves that your brain is doing evolutionary stuff to hold you back from achieving the best version of yourself. That $1 million mindset, perspective, super powerful.
What a brilliant note to end on, Dave. Thank you so much for coming on the Sober Awkward podcast. I feel like I don't need that therapist now, actually. Is there anything you want to end with?
Oh, I'm just so happy and privileged and humbled to be part of this. Like, a random text message to yourself thinking I'm not a creeper has led to, hopefully listeners have taken away one thing from what we shared today, because that can have a positive impact on the world. Sharing, listening, learning is a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. Thanks, Dave. Yeah, and that was my conversation with Dave. Wow. What do you think about that, Hamish?
It's connected a lot of dots for me, that conversation.
Okay.
We all know that you feel afraid of being left out of a group, and that is why some people choose not go sober, or why some people return to drinking having been sober, because they feel like they're not getting invited to the parties. And I sort of thought, well, what is that? Because we don't like to think it is insecurity, because insecurity is a word we don't like to think that we feel. So I was like, oh, I don't feel insecure. I'm not that afraid of not being invited to some things, but it being like genetically in our brains over millions and millions of years. And it's not a fear of not being invited to things, not being included. It's a fear of death, which is kind of ironic as well, because a lot of people give up drinking because of a fear of death.
Yeah.
If I carry on like this, I might die. Or if I carry on like this, my quality of life will completely diminish, even if it doesn't kill me. So the idea of then returning to drinking because of a fear of death is sort of oxymoronic.
It is oxymoronic. Good word.
Thank you very much.
Well done.
What about you? What are the standout moments of your chat?
I think it was the millionaire mindset. He kind of snuck that in there as a little gem at the end, yeah. didn't he? And yeah. I was absolutely blown away by that little nugget of wisdom there. I just couldn't believe that such a simple statement could have such a massive impact. I've actually used it already.
How have you used it? What have you done? So you interviewed him, what, a week or so ago? What have you done in the last week that you used it on?
Actually, somebody texted me who's struggling with drinking and saying, I don't know what to do, I can't stop. And I said, if I gave you $1 million, would you stop? And they were like, yeah. I was like, well, there you go.
Oh, you used it to share the love. I thought it was going to be like, I really don't want to do the laundry. Yeah. But $1 million, I thought it was going to be something more menial than
I'm
that.
I'm not that stupid.
Okay, so you're passing on wisdom already.
I am passing on Dave's wisdom already.
Okay, sweet.
I said, there's nothing stopping you. If you can do it for $1 million, you can do it for anything. I mean, it's true, isn't
it? Did they go, do you have $1 million?
Yeah, they just don't text me anymore.
So, yeah, you think you'll implement that in your life for certain things?
I am absolutely going to implement that. I think it's just a brilliant and very, very simple way of looking at things. I also really resonated with the values. I think we lose track of our values sometimes. Mm-hmm. I often rate my values on other people's opinions of me.
Okay, explain that.
So I often worry about what people think about me rather than sticking to my values. Because I know that my values are good, but then I get drawn into wondering whether somebody else thinks they're good.
Right, yes. And then you change them.
And then I change them.
Also, you use the words resonated there. I've spent this week going through your old episodes with Lucy to edit them together for Thursday, and I forgot that resonate was one of your least favourite words, along with journey.
Journey, and I really resonate with
you. So have you changed in the last 2 years where now resonate is okay? It's on the good word list again.
It's not on the good word list. I cringed when I said it. Oh, yeah. So anyway, there's a lot of deep stuff that came from that episode with Dave. I just found it so brilliant. It really made my life a little bit clearer. And I hope it does for the people at home today to get all that explained. Rejection is really something we feel at some point in our lives, everybody. And it can be hurtful. But what really matters is how we handle it. It seems it really comes down to our core values.
Yeah, rejection is something sober people especially will probably have to deal with at some point. There are probably going to be some pissed up mates that will decide out of the blue that you're not cool anymore because you don't down absinthe at Chicago's nightclub every Friday night. The texts might stop and the WhatsApp groups that had disappeared.
This is my bad writing.
This isn't it. It's wild that you've written a book. The texts might stop and the WhatsApp groups might disappear from your phone or stop ringing altogether. And well, that's okay. You don't have to start drinking again just because you're different now. You might have to do what Dave did with Vic and search out some people that have the same interests and values as you.
I think we should all go home now, get a pen and paper and write as if we were on our deathbeds. I know it sounds a bit morbid, but how do you really want to be remembered? And then follow those rules. It takes so much questioning and worrying out of the equation. And we should also think about how bloody amazing us sober people are by choosing to step out of the crowd, even though it makes us feel awkward. We are carving our own path, not following the mainstream. And that is very fucking cool.
The best thing to do if you are feeling rejected is to remember why you gave up booze and then go and find some sober mates to play Scrabble with. Is that the best thing?
Yeah, that's the best thing. Go find sober mates
Scrabble.
To play Scrabble with. Yeah.
The best thing you can do is
best
play
thing in the world.
Scrabble.
Yeah, best thing ever.
What lack of games are on my shelf when the best one is Scrabble?
Twister then, Twister. That's more
that's
exciting
enough.
For you.
Go play Twister. Get some therapy and talk about how you're feeling with someone. Don't let the rejection of others send your sobriety off track. You just keep doing you.
Well, we've got some quotes here, Hamish. I'll start. Most fears of rejection rest on the desire for approval from other people. Don't base your self-esteem on their opinions.
Oh, that's
a good one.
That's speaking
that's
to
me,
literally what you
me.
Just said. That was Harvey McKay or McKay. And Brian Tracy says, if rejection destroys your self-esteem, you're letting others hold you as an emotional hostage.
Oh, yeah.
Those two are clearly
I'm going to add my own quote here now, Hamish.
I love it when you quote yourself.
Yeah, here we go. Remember,
sober or not, some people are just cunts.
That's lovely. Is that in your book? Or is that
I just made it up now.
I was going to say, maybe in my head you were like, you know those magnets you get in a fridge and you can write your own words?
Yes.
You've done that at your children's eye level.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. It's not quite Aristotle, Hamish, but it works, I think.
That's it. Yeah. Vicky Vanstone, not quite Aristotle, but it does work. Well, that's my next Google book review of yours.
Excellent. Thanks for listening, everybody.
If you're questioning your relationship with booze, you're struggling to moderate, or your hangovers are causing anxiety, it might be time to reach out for some support.
Yeah, just talk to a mate about how you're feeling, contact a local doctor, find an AA or sobriety group. Vic's got one.
Yeah, just head to www.cuppa.community.
Remember, if you're questioning yourself, it might be time to seek support.
Even though this journey can be awkward, it is definitely worth it. And if you've enjoyed the Sober Awkward podcast, don't forget to review it, rate it, and share it with your mates.
They have to share it with their mates?
Yeah, of course they do. I'm not doing this for nothing, Hamish. Bloody hell.
How do they share it?
I don't know. Just write it on
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So, as you probably know, my comedy memoir, 1,000 Wasted Sundays, is officially out. All my magnificent fuck-uppery in one awkward hit. If you'd like to get your hands on a copy, it's now available from all good bookstores.
We always say all good bookstores, don't we? Yeah. Are there bad bookstores?
No, it's probably ones with moody sellers.
Oh, yeah, really yeah. Depressed librarian folks.
Yes, okay, yes, good, yeah. Good. So there are probably some, but we're only storing it in the good ones.
It's only made it into the goodies.
You can also get it from all good online retailers. The print version and ebook are out now, and the audiobook will be available in March. I've been writing my memoir for 5 years. It will make you laugh, cry and cringe and hopefully inspire a few people to reconsider their relationship with booze. If you love the podcast, then I think you'll love the book, even if I do say so myself. Hamish has read it. What did you think?
I feel like I know a little bit too much about you now, to be honest, Vic. Look, I really loved it. It was hilarious and surprisingly moving, but I feel like I've seen you naked in a literary sense.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's worrying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From an emotional point of view, seriously, it wobbled my teeny weeny wooden heart, Vic.
Okay.
My teeny little wooden heart.
Well, his teeny little, his wooden heart is broken. Anyway, so if you do manage to get your filthy mitts on a copy, please do me a favour and head to goodreads.com and give me a review. Doing that will help me get it out there to those that need a bit of sober support. So there you have it. My story, unwanted warts and all. Come and get awkward with me.
Not to be too demanding or anything, but seriously, go and buy it.
Yeah,
now.
Go and buy it. Go and buy it right now.
Yeah, don't just tell your friends. Buy it, and then buy your friends one or two.
Yeah, yeah. Don't give them a copy. Yeah. Buy it. Yeah.
And you know what? Don't be careful where you store it. If you lose it, you can always buy another five.
Yeah, buy another one.
Yeah.